I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Joining us on the line at the present time, Andrew Arthur, resident fellow in law and policy for the Center for Immigration Studies. Recently, there was an article in The Hill called Biden Walking Back Immigration Promises for a Reason. Art, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Neil.
You know, Art, there's an old saying, you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose. And during this lead up to the inauguration, as you begin to start embracing more of how you're going to govern, I have been completely mystified by so many different changes that the Biden administration has really kind of walked back from what he aggressively said he would do in the first 100 days, not 60 days ago.
Yeah, and, you know, in reality, it was inevitable. It all made sense. A lot of the promises that he made, and keep in mind, you know, Joe Biden has been in Washington since I think he was, just old enough to be a senator. So, you know, this is a guy who, you know, really does sort of understand what the issues are. But of course, when you're running for president, most of the people that you're speaking to don't understand what the issues are. And a lot of the promises that the former vice president made on the campaign trail were just reactions to, Donald Trump. In reality, you know, immigration enforcement under Donald Trump really wasn't, you know, that different. In many ways, was actually less, you know, stringent or less strident than it was under Barack Obama. And one of the biggest issues that the Biden administration is going to face, of course, is the border. Donald Trump has instituted a number of policies that have restricted the number of people entering illegally. For your listeners, and I know that you know this, but in FY 2019, we had almost a million people enter the United States illegally, and about 60% of those were, people with kids or unaccompanied alien children, as we say, or UACs, but, you know, kids who had entered the United States illegally themselves. Border Patrol doesn't have the capacity to actually deal with those people. Border Patrol facilities were built in the 80s and 90s when about 90% of everybody that they dealt with was from Mexico and 90% were single adults. So, you know, those facilities are built to process people in about 8 hours and turn them around and send them back to Mexico. They're not built to, you know, handle 14-year-old children. They're not built to, you know, separate, minor girls from adult males. Biden understands this very well because a lot of court cases, you know, came out of the Obama-Biden administration, and they were against them for detaining those individuals in, less than ideal circumstances. If you remember the whole kids in cages trope, you know, those barriers were erected during the Obama administration because they realized they couldn't handle the population. So the infrastructure really hasn't changed in the last 30 years. And Biden knows that if there is a rush of individuals at the border, there's going to be a humanitarian disaster, which is going to lead to a drug disaster and a national security disaster as well. So the former vice president, now that, you know, he's about to become the 46th president of the United States, recognizes the facts on the ground, is changing his tune.
Yeah, and I'm sure this is going to happen yet over and over again. The Biden administration, the group that they've put together under Alex Mayorkas. I think that's how you say his name.
It is, yes.
Thank you. You know, this most recent report of the fiscal year 2020 enforcement lifecycle report, which is an annual report that's put out by Homeland Security, looking at these immigration statistics, looking at how many cases they actually get through the immigration court system, that they get resolved, so forth and so on. And what this report really highlights, some of what you just talked about, was that we continue to have an incredible backlog. In fact, as of November of 2020, 1.28 million cases still on the docket, yet to be decided. And what's really interesting is that just the other day, Vice President-elect Kamala Harris said that they were going to be adding more judges. Immigration advocates kind of went crazy saying, we don't want more judges. We want the rules and the underlying laws to change so that we win more cases in this court, because we're not winning any cases. In fact, the vast majority, I think you would agree, are being sent back to their origin country.
Yeah, and, you know, we've seen the numbers. I was a former immigration judge myself. We only have 520 immigration judges. You can do the math. That's, you know, close to 2,000 cases per judge. And those cases, you know, especially asylum, which is about 40% of the total, take about 4 hours to complete. So, you know, you can do the math and figure out that you just don't have enough immigration judges out there. And part of the problem is, you know, there are a lot of good cases. There are people who need the protection of the United States, and it's absolutely fundamental to our national character that we extend protection to people who are fleeing persecution. We have ever since the end of World War II, and even before. And, you know, it's sort of one of the foundational bases of this country going back to the Pilgrims. But, you know, there are a lot of bad cases. There are a lot of people who simply want to exploit that asylum system in order to, you know, get into the United States to remain here indefinitely. So separating the good cases from the bad cases is absolutely crucial to making sure that we protect the, you know, the people in the good cases. And, you know, there, of course, is a lot of discussion about these issues, you know, whether, you know, Trump's asylum rules are, you know, too strict or too loose. But the asylum law itself is actually written in a very restrictive manner. You can only get asylum for persecution based on race, religion, national origin, membership in a particular social group, or political opinion. So, you know, if you live in an area where there's a lot of conflict, there's a lot of crime, you're subjected to crime all the time, you're not eligible for asylum in the United States. But, you know, the other problem, of course, for the Biden administration is getting to those good cases, because a lot of those people who do have claims, their loved ones are in danger abroad as well. And so, you know, once you get asylum, you can petition to get those people out of harm's way. But, you know, so many bad cases, you know, some of them are just, you know, just not valid. Some of them are fraudulent. And, you know, getting through that has been a key of the last three attorneys general under President Trump, you know, beginning with Jeff Sessions. You know, we've seen a 70% increase in the hiring of immigration judges. When I left, I think there were, you know, just south of 300 immigration judges. So, you know, it's absolutely crucial to have more personnel in the courts doing this. Congress has been very chintzy, though, as it relates to providing money for those individuals, providing money for the courts, but they play an absolutely key role. So it makes sense that, you know, soon-to-be Vice President Kamala Harris would make those statements, you know, it to be soon-to-be President Biden actually promised that on the campaign trail. It was, you know, sort of lost in the noise. But yeah, I mean, we have a huge problem with immigration because there are a lot of people in the system and not a lot of people to deal with them.
One of the other things that occurred to me, the immigration court, if you have a case and you're waiting for a hearing, the average wait time is 849 days, 2 years, 3 months. All the while, and I think one of the things that the Biden administration recognized right away is that if we've got this operational backlog, or, you know, throughput backlog trying to get through the system, and we're adding additional pressure not only at the border but those coming, you know, from other points of entry separate and apart from the border. How can we ever catch up? You know, and I know the first inclination is to add more judges, but when you start looking at these numbers, it's going to be, you would have to quadruple five, maybe six times the numbers of immigration judges to be had, unless there's a relaxation of the rules and you just start just simply allowing people in. What they also notice is that under catch and release, as opposed to keeping those incarcerated, they can work those cases a lot faster than they can the catch and release cases, which is, having been in law enforcement for 40 years, that doesn't surprise me by any stretch of the imagination. So you've been there. What do you do? How do you get caught up, and how does this ever become to make any kind of sense?
Well, detention is absolutely key, you know, because you know, if the whole idea is that you're entering the United States in order to live and work here, but you're detained, and the odds are you're not going to end up being successful in your case, you're not going to come. So if you look at the life cycle report, one of the things that they say is 98% of all of the people who were detained throughout the entire process ended up getting repatriated. Once we release people, though, that's where you get into those big numbers. I think it's 1,061 days. In Denver, fortunately, in New Orleans, it's only 650 days for the average case to be done. So if you're looking for your case to be done quickly, New Orleans is the place to go. But, you know, 40 years ago, the Supreme Court said every continuance in an immigration case benefits the alien. Because, again, if your point is to come here and live here indefinitely, the longer your case stretches out, the longer you get to stay. So what you need to do is you need to remove the incentives in the system for people to game the system and file, you know, frivolous motions to continue, to slow walk their cases to remain. But you need more people. And, you know, look, we're the United States government. We can, you know, we're the biggest government in the history of man. And, you know, being an immigration judge pays about $185,000 a year. You get a black robe and a pre-nominal that you can use forever, and people stand up when you walk in the room, although, quite frankly, each of those things is ridiculous once you've had for a week. But, you know, so it is an attractive job. There are people who are willing to do it, good lawyers, who believe in the system and believe in the United States. You know, so there are people out there. The only thing that is required is the will to actually get that done. But we also need to limit the number of people who are coming over at the border so we don't add to that backlog. And that really is the biggest source of cases that are getting added to that backlog, which is why, again, returning to the your original topic, the Biden administration knows that it has to limit the number of people entering the United States illegally, because nothing is going to turn people. You know, it was the big reason why Trump got elected. You know, we saw huge surges of kids at the border in 2014 and 2016, and the Obama administration didn't respond appropriately or effectively to that. And, you know, Trump, under Sessions, Whitaker, and Barr, actually did. You know, they did expand capacity. But, you know, that's how you end up with those huge waves of people coming in, because they know if they get in, you know, the average is 826 a day or whatever it is, days. But, you know, in reality, you can be in proceedings for 6 years, and that's time that you get to live here, that you get to work here. And if that's your goal, you know, you're going to be successful. So tamping down the number of people entering illegally and expanding your capacity to deal with them is absolutely key.
So what is the goal then for, and I hate to use it in the general sense of Democrats, but let me just use it in the sense of immigration advocacy groups, is to delay, create a humanitarian issue, and then try to play upon the emotions of this country to remediate that humanitarian issue after folks have been here 5, 6, 7, 8 years. We finally get the case resolved because, you know, the system, the infrastructure of the system is not robust enough to handle it, and then we play upon those emotions. Would that be a fair characterization?
Yeah. Daddy, you are spot on correct. And quite frankly, you know, your statement shows that you're more of an immigration expert than most of the people making immigration decisions in the United States. That's exactly what happened with DACA. you know, President Obama knew that if he granted, you know, benefits to a very sympathetic group of individuals, you know, and quite frankly, I believe that it was, you know, illegal the way that he did it, and he'd previously said he didn't have the power to do it, that there was going to become more and more pressure to give those people permanent benefits. And, you know, the courts, including the Supreme Court, in, you know, blocking the end of DACA, has really just made things worse for those people. Because if there actually were, if DACA were to end, Congress would act quickly. In fact, President Trump even stated Congress will quickly have a bill to give these people real relief. But, you know, DACA is really just a stalking horse for the bigger goals, and that is, you know, next you're going to hear people talking about, well, we need to grant benefits to the parents of citizens and people who have green cards. And that's about 5.3 million people, give or take. And then it's going to be, well, if we're granting benefits to those people, if we're going to grant them amnesty, which is what it is, you know, then we should just grant amnesty to everybody, restart the entire system. And this time, we promise that we're going to do it right, and we're going to enforce the laws. But, you know, that was a promise that we heard back in 1986. We got the, you know, everybody got the amnesty, but we didn't get the enforcement that we were promised. And so, you know, that really is the key to any of this. You know, is it going to be 645,000 DACA recipients? Is it going to be that 5.3 million parents? Or is it going to be some larger number? And, you know, if it is, what do we do? We're one of the few countries in the world that, you know, bases its immigration system on who you're related to. More than 60% of the people who get green cards get their green cards through some sort of familial relationship, not based upon the skills that they bring to this country or their ability to grow our economy, which is what Canada and the UK and Australia do. You know, it's based on who you're related to. And all the way back in 1995, a woman, you know, a true patriot, Barbara Jordan, civil rights icon, said, you know, that's not the way to run this system. You know, absent exceptional circumstances, immigration to the United States should be based on skills. And President Trump attempted to do that, but, you know, the usual advocacy groups came out and said, oh, you can't do that, you're breaking up families. You know, bring your wife, bring your kids, your husband and your kids to the United States. You know, if you get a green card, fine. But really, is there any benefit to, you know, them or to the American people when we say that you can bring your nieces and nephews, which is what the current immigration laws allow? You know, there's no guarantee those people know, you know, have the skills to succeed.
Or grandparents or great-grandparents.
Or you know, parents or great-grandparents. You know, one of the things that immigration advocates will often say is we have an aging population, we have the Social Security burden, so we need to bring more immigrants to the United States. But because people are allowed to immigrate their parents to the United States, we've actually seen the age of immigrants get older, and that in turn has actually made the average age in the United States older. So, you know, it's this big promise that we're going to get, you know, the, you know, 21-year-old nuclear engineer, but often you get the, you know, 58-year-old who's about to retire coming to this country or older. So, you know, if we really need to reexamine those things and determine, you know, but again, we are a big-hearted people, you know, even, you know, as much as President Trump was derided, you know, many of his immigration policies were intended to protect people from smugglers, were intended to, you know, protect the system so that future immigrants can take advantage of it. Immigration is absolutely crucial to the American experiment. But as Barbara Jordan said, if the American people lose faith in immigration, it's over. And, you know, the immigration is no more a guarantee than democracy is. It's something that, you know, people have to, you know, have faith in, support, you know, at the voting booth all the way up to, you know, the Speaker of the House and the presidency. So, you know, it's not guaranteed. And we can remember, you know, after September 11th, there were a lot of people who said shut down immigration entirely. So, you know, this isn't a purely theoretical issue. We've seen it happen in our lifetimes. And, you know, that was the point of laws that were passed in the 20s because, you know, people were concerned about the country's ability to actually, bring American values to the folks who were coming to this country. I think that a lot of those, you know, most of those concerns were overblown, but they were real.
Andrew, we got to get to a break. We'll be right back. Andrew Arthur, resident fellow in law and policy for the Center for Immigration Studies, talking about President-elect Biden walking back immigration promises for a reason. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. We're talking to Andrew Arthur, resident fellow in law and policy for the Center for Immigration Studies. Andrew, you said that you served as an immigration judge, and I'd love to get your reaction to a couple of questions because I really just don't know the answers. I hear the anecdotal stories back and forth from the left, from the right. I'm sure the truth is somewhere in between. What are the options for you as a judge if you have presented before you an unaccompanied alien child that we simply have no information about their parents or believe their parents to still be in the origin country?
Yeah, and, you know, I'm actually a good source to ask that question to because I had jurisdiction over the Berks Family Center, which at the time was the only, facility, residential facility that ICE had in order to deal with unaccompanied alien children. And, you know, keep in mind that it's not like a four-year-old wakes up in San Pedro Sula and decides to walk to the United States. There's a sophisticated process that's in place, an illegal one at that, of smugglers, which is anywhere between a $3.5 billion and $4.3 billion a year industry, to bring those individuals to the United States. So when you're talking about a child of tender age, you actually get, you know, special training to elicit from them, you know, what exactly their history is, you know, who they have in the United States, and what the reason for coming here is. But, you know, the most important thing is to get that person some sort of representation that can help to get that information. And, you know, I was fortunate to have a very strong pro bono bar, people who are willing to step up and take those cases. When you're talking about a 17-year-old, and keep in mind, when my father was 17, he was working in a steel mill in Baltimore. It's a completely different story because those individuals are, you know, better able to give you an idea of where they are. But, you know, I'm a father. And if, my kid were, 12 years old and I were to, wake up and find out that he was in France or, you know, anywhere else in the world, I would want my child back. And, you know, the policy of the United States government really needs to be the repatriation of those children so that they can get back with their families and their home countries. But unfortunately, that's exactly the opposite of what the law does. The current laws, actually, if a child is from a third country, not Mexico or Canada, is to, you know, put them with Health and Human Services, which really doesn't make any sense, who places them in shelters and then attempts to place them in the United States. And, you know, that itself is a very difficult process because we've seen abuses of those systems. And there's always the possibility that that child's been trafficked to the United States. We had a horrible situation in Ohio a number of years back in which a bunch of unaccompanied alien children came to this country, ended up working in, you know, what was basically bondage in Ohio on an egg farm. They were in a rickety house. And they were forced to work, you know, hours a day, taking care of chickens and taking care of eggs. So, you know, we really need to rethink the system that we have right now for how we deal with those children. But the flip side of that is most of those kids, you know, actually have parents in the United States. And it's those parents that paid for the smugglers to bring them to this country to begin with. We know that when HHS, you know, sends them to shelters, the whole idea is that they're supposed to be, you know, placed with sponsors in the United States, but about 58% of those sponsors are here illegally, and they themselves have paid the smugglers to bring them to the United States. Now, this is not, you know, like me putting you on, you know, Southwest Airlines and flying you from National to, you know, to New Orleans. This is me trusting my child with a criminal, you know, in the middle of nowhere through many perils. In April 2019, a bipartisan federal panel determined those children were horribly traumatized and exploited in many instances on their way to the United States. So we need to have a system that, you know, dissuades people from paying smugglers to bring their kids to the United States. We need to hold those parents accountable for, you know, paying those smugglers. But we also need to deal with those children in a humanitarian manner. So, you know, it is an extremely difficult process and one that the law has actually made much worse because it's created incentives for unaccompanied alien children to enter the United States illegally and for their parents to have them smuggled to this country illegally.
The other issue that we hear a lot about, and obviously it touches the hearts of many Americans, is these allegations whereby Border Patrol and others at the border are actually separating children from their family. Is that a normal course of action, or is that pursuant to some directive within Border Patrol or otherwise?
Well, there was Attorney General Sessions back when he was the Attorney General wanted to, you know, truly, you know, remove the incentives for people coming to the United States. So he said everybody who can be prosecuted for illegal entry, and keep in mind entering the United States is not just an immigration offense, it's a federal criminal offense, should be prosecuted. But the way that the system is set up, when you prosecute those individuals, they go into Department of Justice custody, which means that their children who had previously been in DHS custody are now unaccompanied alien children and go to HHS. That's, you know, just the way that the law works. And so what ended up happening was they would be
very similar to U.S. citizens if there aren't no other family members. And
yeah,
both parents are in prison, the children go with some social service organization, right?
Yeah, and, you know, we see this, you know, happen every day with military families where, you know, one parent, sometimes both, you know, end up getting deployed. We see this in the criminal justice system every day. But, you know, when it related to, you know, immigration, you know, it, you know, became a hot-button issue. And respectfully to the folks at DHS and HHS, they really didn't do a very good job of handling it. Now, a lot of those parents ended up getting deported from the United States, and, you know, they didn't want their kids to come with them. So when you hear about, you know, some number, 645 or, you know, 222 or whatever number they, you know, are touting at the given time, a lot of those parents want their kids to remain in the United States for two reasons. One, they figure their kids are going to live a better life in the United States, which is probably true. Two, they hope that someday they're going to be able to come to the United States, that their kids get to remain in the United States. A lot of those parents also are living in the United States illegally. They don't want anybody in the federal government to know where they are. So when the federal government goes looking for them, they have a tough time finding them. And, you know, a lot of people who are purportedly sponsors, you know, don't respond when the government reaches out to find out, you know, where those children are. So, you know, that's a factor in the system as well. Now, keep in mind, that process that I described lasted for about 2 months. President Trump actually shut it down by executive order. And, you know, but, you know, we're still dealing with the fallout. But, yeah, I mean, if you are a parent and you show up at the border with a child, not only aren't you separated, but you're more likely to be released, which creates an incentive for people to bring their children to the United States, which is the worst of all possible scenarios. Because, as I mentioned, you know, those kids get traumatized. That bipartisan, and again, this is Democrats and Republicans coming together and agreeing on something. A report from April of 2019 said that, you know, that, which is not in the Immigration and Nationality Act, but rather as a result of a court order interpreting a 24-year-old settlement agreement, needed to be undone. Congress had to act to implement legislation so that, you know, we wouldn't quickly release every adult that showed up with at the border with a child. Now, Congress didn't do anything at all about that. All they really did was complain about the treatment of, you know, those families and those kids at the border. And, you know, that was a derogation of responsibility of the highest order, because rather than, you know, actually caring for those people, they made it a political issue. Your senators in Louisiana, you know, understand these issues. But unfortunately, a lot of other elected representatives would prefer to make political hay out of it rather than actually responding to that. I mean, this is a trauma, Noel. You know, when you're talking about, you know, criminal smuggling gangs that have to deal with cartels, that have to, you know, bring people thousands of miles to the United States, you know, through some pretty rough areas, you know, there's going to be not only problems for the adults, but problems for the children. We know that about two-thirds of those migrants are assaulted on the way to the United States, and a significant proportion of the female migrants are, you know, subject to sexual assault. Now, nobody ever, you know, advertises that fact, because we only want to focus on migrants when they get to the United States and criticize the way that the United States government deals with them. And they need to be dealt with in the most humanitarian way possible. But, you know, keep in mind, Border Patrol agents were literally paying money out of their own pockets to buy formula and diapers for, you know, child migrants that parents had brought with them during the, you know, brief period of time that they were, you know, detained by the Border Patrol before we could find a place to send them. So, you know, the images don't really tell the story. The story is much more complex. But even the Obama administration, you know, went to great pains to, you know, attempt to deter people from bringing your kids to the United States. They had, you know, public service announcements in the countries from which they came, which were primarily El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, you know, not to do this. Because it is
Andrew,
so
we got to get to another break. We'll be right back. We're talking with Andrew Arthur, resident fellow in law and policy for the Center for Immigration Studies, talking about whether or not President-elect Biden will be able to accomplish what he has promised in the first 100 days. We'll be right back. We're back with Andrew Arthur, resident fellow in law and policy for the Center for Immigration Studies, talking about some of the challenges in and around unaccompanied alien children. We hear a lot about that. Andrew, one thing that kind of caught my eye the other day, President-elect Biden said that they were going to be conducting criminal investigations relative to the separation of family and children at the border. And if things were done intentionally to circumvent the law, they would be prosecuted. And I was just kind of curious. I mean, you've got your finger on the pulse of this. I had not seen a whole lot of allegations about that actually occurring, or did I just miss it?
No, I haven't seen any, you know, actual facts. And, you know, one of the things that we've been talking about, you know, in recent weeks is, you know, well, you know, you can have all the assertions that you want, but what are the facts? And when it comes down to this, you know, I don't know that there are any actual facts out there. Now, again, when you're talking about any, you know, major bureaucracy, any, you know, law enforcement organization, there are a whole lot of good people. But, you know, sometimes there are some bad people, too. So I can't tell you that, you know, nothing that was actionable happened. But I would be very surprised if it were, and there are a couple of reasons for that. But the most significant one is the amount of oversight that goes into the system. There is an Office of the Inspector General at DHS that is, you know, well-run, well-staffed, full of diligent people. Congress has oversight authority. I exercised that authority when I worked for two House committees, House Oversight and House Judiciary. You've got the Government Accountability Office that can investigate those things. So, you know, DHS OIG actually did look into the circumstances of, you know, that separation policy, which, again, really didn't go on for that long. People might be under the mistaken impression that it is, but, And, you know, they found that things could have been done better, but, there were no criminal referrals in there that I saw. And, with the number of people that you have who are looking, could be looking, and given the heated passions at the time, would have been looking into the situation. I actually testified before House Appropriations on this issue. If there were wrongdoing of that sort, it would have been ferreted out. But there wasn't. And so, I almost think that that's just, a talking point. And again, I have no problem with any investigation that the government wants to carry out. I just don't think they're going to find very much at the end.
Your gut feeling as to how much is actually going to be accomplished in the first year of the Biden administration relative to these issues. It seems to me that we go and we try and tweak one silo, and we don't recognize that by tweaking that silo, we've actually impacted six other silos. And that's kind of always been the approach from my perspective of immigration.
Yeah, no, it is, that's spot on correct. It's a balloon that when you squeeze in one part, you have problems in the other. And there are individuals, who have purely pure motives, who, come up with ideas like, treating, a third country national unaccompanied alien children in such a way that would encourage people to, send them to the United States, that ends up having some truly dire consequences. It needs to be looked at holistically. And, frankly, Congress has abrogated its responsibility. There hasn't been any major immigration legislation since 2005. But the immigration, problem has grown worse year after year. There's a lot of an anecdote that Abraham Lincoln used to tell about the preacher who was out on a ride when a thunderstorm came up. He took shelter under a tree, and lightning struck the tree, and he fell on his knees and said, "A little bit more light, Lord, and a little bit less noise." And when it comes to this situation, that's really what we need is a little bit more light. That's one of the things that, we at the Center for Immigration Studies attempt to do. I use my experience at the INS as a judge on the Hill to, put these things into context and to explain, what's going on and what the real impacts of these policies are. But unfortunately, immigration has become a political football for both parties over the past two decades. And, that really has prevented, real structural changes from taking place.
Absolutely. I really enjoy talking to folks that were boots on the ground, and I love your perspective on this. Thank you so much for joining us. Learned a lot today. Hope to get you back on because I know this is going to be a hot button issue for the incoming administration, and it will be interesting to see what path they take. Have a great week, my friend.
Thank you, Newell, and go Saints.
Yeah, there you go. Love that, too. Andrew Arthur, resident fellow in law and policy for the Center for Immigration Studies. We will be right back, folks. Stay with us.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.